Okay, so tonight is our first part in a two-part series called Kairos. And tonight is definitely going to be a night that we're going to do some reading together. Because there's so much to talk about, and it's said so well by people who are not me, that we're going to do some reading together, and we're going to break down some stuff. But I want to set the stage in a somewhat different way. I want to talk to you about birthdays. Let's talk about birthdays, because most people are fans of birthdays. It's hard not, well, I still really am a big fan of birthdays. My kids love birthdays. What makes birthdays so special? Why do birthdays seem to matter to people? Oh, not a rhetorical question, like something you actually say out loud to me instead. No. Should clarify. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, and when it's not there, we obviously don't throw a birthday party for just a baby. We're talking not just celebrates their birth, but a certain passage of time, right? And what makes? Does anybody have like a birthday family tradition that is special to you? Like something that really stands out to you? Really, guys? Come on. Fine. Yes, that's great.
I mean, if I see somebody on social media, oh, it's my child's birthday. Like,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Well, so I always thank my wife on my kid's birthday, because that there is no kid's birthday without my wife. So, there's that in of itself is celebrating that woman, or even a father in that sense is celebrating the fullness of life, right? It's not just that person, but it's an event that brings in all sorts of people into it, right? Why else do we celebrate birthdays? Or what if anybody has a something that's important to you that you do? David.
When I used to, I'm not able to now, but on my birthday, I would go and give blood.
Oh, awesome.
Because, and they would ask me, you know, when you're on your birthday, they say, yeah, but, you know, my mother gave me birth on my birthday, so
Yeah. Giving
blood is like giving life.
Yeah, so that's super cool.
I'm not able to no more because I'm part of medication.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Cake.
So you got to have stuff, right? I feel like even cavemen had like we've been lighting candles before candles were a thing, you know, like, you know, cavemen have a birthday and, you know, drag back like a, I don't know, like a tiger and stick a stick in it, and light it on fire and be like, you're welcome. There's something about we institutionalize, and not only institutionalize but celebrate the passage of time. In my house, the rule is everybody gets their own special dinner, and we go around the table, and everyone's supposed to share one thing that we love about that person, something that really stands out to us as something that we value and cherish. And that's always a really cool. It's been really interesting to watch as my kids get older what they notice in their siblings, and Sarah and I always come up with something new to say to that child, because they're constantly growing, right? And in the passage of time, we see the evolution of that person becoming more of what we believe that God made them. So when you think about birthdays and maybe cavemen and the celebration of birthdays, my point here is that as human beings, celebrations at key times in the year are very, very natural. So natural that it's as if there's something innate inside it. Something that is human, that pre-exists us, that almost demands that we celebrate. Meaning like even kids will play pretend parties. And birthdays have been around since cavemen and flaming sticks. So the idea is that creatures, all of humanity has been celebrating stuff for a very long time. And it's not just because we like parties. I think that there's something unique about gathering together and offering something. That's what a birthday is. That, you know, we talk about the birthday cake, right? It's an offering. Here you go. And presents. And there's something human about focusing on the gift to someone else. So when you look at in history, you see us working it out, right? So before there are all sorts of non-Christian holidays that slowly evolve, right? There's lots of famous things about the Christmas tree and Halloween and all sorts of fun pagan yada yadas. And so as you look at that stuff, we see, again, human beings interacting with nature, the stuff around them, and celebrating it. So when we talk about time and we talk about God and we talk about worship, we're talking about two things that are related but not the same: Kairos and Chronos. And I'm going to give you the punchline now, because getting us from Kairos to Chronos to here might be difficult. The Catholic Church has we've got a calendar just to throw parties. We have a calendar just to throw parties, and that calendar just to throw parties is called the liturgical calendar or a liturgical year. And it's not like a Gregorian year. It's a year unto itself. Okay, so the punchline to tonight is that God has an order to which people ought to worship. Now, that may not be exactly the liturgical calendar, but my point is that God desires a spiritual rhythm in our lives on a daily basis that goes all the way up to Kairos and Chronos. And then at somewhere in between, we find the Catholic Church in a liturgical calendar. So what's going to get us from here to the end of this session is we're going to go from Kairos and Chronos to hopefully get to the liturgical calendar and how the Catholic Church celebrates its worship, and also hopefully maybe a little bit of how what that looks like every day. All right, I'm gonna put that over here. Liturgical calendar. Remember that liturgy means a work offered on behalf of the people. So we have a calendar of work offered on behalf of the people. When you look at the way that we celebrate, hopefully that'll put it in some context. On your page, I printed off two quotes at the top that talk about Kairos and Chronos. Okay, so it's a little tongue in cheek for me when we were advertising Kairos as being like God's time, but it fits. And this comes from a book called Everything You Wanted to Know About Heaven by a guy named Peter Kreeft. Now, that probably is, it's really a quite lame name for the book, because it's pretty phenomenal. And he himself is an eminent philosopher, Catholic philosopher out of Boston College. But it's a really fantastic book. Everything You Wanted to Know About Heaven and More. So would somebody be willing to read those first couple of sentences, and then we can break them down? Read them out loud. Yes, ma'am.
Kairos.
Kairos.
Live time. there's never enough time for anything, enough kairos, because kairos is bound by chronos here on earth. You good?
Please.
But not in heaven. After death, there will be all the time in the world, more than all the time in the world to learn, to savor, to sink totally into the meaning of everything.
Okay. So chronos is clock time. Yes. See, my drawings have greatly improved since the last time we were together. I've been practicing. So, and kairos is, this doesn't make any sense that I'm drawing a person, but it's time for being, which sounds kind of odd, but clock time and time for being. Now, really, one of the connections that I hope for us to make is that kairos is actually a part of God's time. And that's what that second paragraph is, that we're going to read, is going to talk about. Kairos is a part of God's time. But chronos is the time that I have. Kairos is the time that for me to become. And so when we say there's never enough time, I mean, you read it there. There's never enough time for me to become. That's the limit that we in the human condition, that we find ourselves constantly coming up against this sense of experience, the limits of our encounters, the limits of our experiences, the limits to what we want to say, what we want to do, who we want to see. Those are in some ways being, becoming, encountering. All of the things that are good and beautiful and true that we wish we could have more of is our desire for kairos, this never-ending adventure. Okay? So there are three levels. I'm going to read the second part. There are three levels of reality: the human, the superhuman, and the subhuman. Humanity, God, and the material world. Each has its own kind of duration that is natural to it. Eternity for God, kairos for humanity, and chronos for the world. Our kairos includes, as one of its dimensions, the world's chronos. For time is a part of our experience, and our kairos is included in God's eternity. God is not an ingredient in our experience. We are ingredients in God's experience. The meaning of our life, our life's time, is in God's eternity. The point of kairos, the point of our lives, what it all points to is eternity. So there's a section after that I took off of the handout because I wanted to keep it to two pages, but later the author goes on to explain how we're all familiar with three-dimensional shapes. The third dimension is chronos. The fourth dimension is kairos. God is the sixth dimension. That's where eternity is the sixth. So it was all like mind-bending for me, and I was like, oh, no, we can't talk about this. But it was really fascinating. That's what he means by dimensions, is that there's this part of the world that is very natural. When we look and say, like, that's very worldly or that's very natural, the things that are running out of time, the human experience, that's chronos. But kairos is a part. Kairos is included in God's eternity. I love this line, we are ingredients in God's experience. It sounds a little impersonal, but it reminds me of that Far Side comic where God is standing in the kitchen and he's got like a turkey, like one of those turkey roaster pans, you know what I'm talking about? And he's got the world in it and he has a jar of people and he's just shaking it on there and be like, this will be interesting. That's not what he means. Okay. What I think Peter Kreef means, well, what do you think Peter Kreef means? When he says, when you read, we are ingredients in God's experience, what does that sound like to you?
subset. And we aren't even close to the whole thing. And so, like, the Taylor's Cronus thing, I was like, oh, man, that's just like calculus. We got to integrate it.
Yeah. That's funny.
But, and so it all came to me like math. And so we're just such a small, you know.
Cool. Yeah, that makes sense. What else? Yes. Yeah. Well, if you were to take it literally, we enrich God's experience, which is something to ponder. That's the whole idea that God creates out of love. It would be like really selfish or nonsensical for Him to create something just for no purpose. But out of His love for us, He finds value in us and enriches His lived experience, not just for Himself. In fact, really, it's for us. But it's something special to think that I enrich God's experience of existence. Anybody else?
Interconnectedness.
Yeah.
To each other and to the Almighty.
Sure. We're all... Sure.
Hold the door.
Okay.
Okay. I get this, and it's very poetic and lovely, and it wraps you in warm, fuzzy feelings.
Yeah.
And all of these ingredients in God's experience today, we have children being raped, we have people starving, people with no clothes, no coats in freezing weather. We have people who are being thrown out of their homes by guerrilla warfare. How is that? I mean, so we also have people born with silver spoons in their mouth and with everything sort of handed to them on silver platters. So we have a whole spectrum of experience. So how is that enhancing God's experience, that these people have to be these, that you're the blue sprinkle and she's the pink sprinkle and he's the purple sprinkle on the birthday cake?
Sure. Yeah, I do. The short answer would be that those things, Cronus is the limiting factor in Kairos, right? Kairos isn't limited by itself. It's limited by Cronus. So I would say that, because really what we're talking about is a problem of evil, which is theicide. So God's experience is not enriched by that suffering, but in God's experience, these are moments that are not limited. They are not limited. We are limited by our experience, but God is not limited by our experience. Right. He's omnipotent.
He wrote the book long before you were created.
Omnipresent.
He knit you together in your mother's womb.
Yeah.
So we have all of these things that the Bible tells us about God's interaction with our creation as the creator. So if he knows every hair on our head, and he knitted us together, and he wrote the book already, he knows these things are going to happen. He knows that this one's going to be a purple sprinkle, and that one's going to be a yellow sprinkle, and so on and so forth. Does that make sense?
It does.
So, I was reading some articles this week, and it's like, does God create knowing that some people won't be in heaven? Does he create those who just are never going to be there?
That's probably deeper than where we want to go immediately. But, so the idea that, so language loses in this exact phrase, which is why we weren't going to stop here. But I will say this, that if we are made in kairos, which is a subset or an integer, a part of God's great eternity, that my even my experience in chronos is not the end. It's not, and that there is fulfillment that is beyond, in both directions in that sense. It's beyond either my beginning and my end, that I am made as a part of God's eternity, and I am going back to that eternity, which is part of that, part of my experience in life is sometimes that can be the blue or the good or the red or the bad. And yet my hope is in that eternity. So to talk about, does God create knowing certain things, that might take us way off. But I would like to answer it, but maybe not like exactly right now. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine. I love the warm, fuzzy, beautiful language. It feels so good. It wraps around you like lamb's wool.
Yeah.
Opens up with it. But there's more.
Yeah.
You know, there's got to be more. There's got to be more to the point. I mean, you know, when we all cook dinner, we use some chili powder over here, mm-hmm. and chili over there, and some vanilla on this, and, you know, whatever. So we use different ingredients.
And oftentimes, so I don't want to be coy, but none of those ingredients are fully aware of the entire picture.
Right.
And so it is in God's infinity, is in His in the broader eternity that He sees the whole picture, which is when we keep it as cold as God and creation, and He's got the big picture, and I just need to deal with it. That is not warm and fuzzy, but it is a practical reality in the sense of we may not fully understand the recipe that we get into this world with or even come out as. Like Paul says, we know it'll be like this. We don't know exactly what we'll be like. So in this context, I think that he certainly, we could answer the question, is does God know and why does He still? Jesus is the crown jewel of that creative. No one has suffered greater than Jesus, in the sense of no one has suffered a greater injustice than Jesus. And yet God still allows that incarnation to occur because we find in it salvation. We then become attached to that salvation and in that experience, that Christ-like experience of suffering in the place and in the moment that we are, in that that chronos, we are enriched by God's kairos. We become more like Him in the way that God has become in the flesh. So that doesn't make it any better per se, but it is... I would say that again. We look back to God's eternity as hopefulness, because if God knew, which He did, there was only one way for Jesus to come, and it was to die. And He is exalted in hope. Then we have that same opportunity there. Outside of Jesus, I would say it would be a very cold and sad existence. I've always wondered, like for me, that I can't even imagine my life not in that hope, in it with any sort of opportunity. So, can that be a half answer?
Okay.
Great.
Well, He uses all the situations to teach someone else as well. So somebody else may be suffering for someone else to learn.
And it is a great mystery. Too often sometimes I think when we talk about suffering in that sense that we almost make like it as an excuse. Oh, well, I'm going to learn from it, which is good. It suffering does teach us things. But it's never at the expense of, right? And yet Jesus Jesus sanctifies suffering. He makes it holy. He redeems it. because it's in his greatest suffering that he is most closely united to the Father. So we find hope in Jesus' suffering. If Jesus, I always wondered, why is the crucifix a sign of like hope and salvation? It's a really not. It's, or at least I didn't think it was. But to me, it's why the cross is so commonly used, is because Jesus isn't on the cross, right? Jesus is risen. But for me, this is very much experience and not, it's transcendent, not theological. When I look at Jesus on the cross, and I'm suffering, I feel like when we look at each other, he says, I understand. I know. Let's go. And so the consequence, suffering is the in some ways the consequence of humanity itself. And yet Jesus is the solution. The problem pre-exists. The problem exists whether we like it or not, but Jesus is the solution. It's in that solution that I can find. The Serenity Prayer is very long. At the end it says that I could be reasonably happy in this life and perfectly happy in the next. And so, period. Okay. Thank you, Doc. That's a fantastic question that I want to follow up on. So this last line in that second paragraph, the point of Kairos, the point of our lives, what it all points to is eternity. So I give you, I borrow a phrase from one of my favorite speakers in the 21st century. His name is Bishop Barron. He says that Jesus is a cosmic warrior. I love this. If you've ever heard me talk about Jesus as a cosmic warrior, then you'll be tired of hearing it because I'd say a lot. Jesus is a cosmic warrior who has come to conquer sin and death. That he's not purely a nice guy. He's not any of these other things. He talks about him in this cosmological sense, that Jesus, who is the Word of God, he is literally, he's eternity itself. He's not a subset. He is this extraordinary, actually, connection. He's not a subset. He is the integration of all subsets. Jesus is a cosmic warrior come out of all of time to conquer sin and death. So when we look at the person of Jesus, who is the center of all Christianity and Catholicism, we look at this time-traveling warrior, okay? It's like Time Cop, but just infinitely better. No one knows that movie because no one's from the 80s. Okay, great. I'm going to stick that one on the shelf with Farmville. So Jesus is at the center of our time as Catholics. So in order to better fit our experience of Jesus in Chronos, the church has devised a means called the liturgical calendar. All right, so we're going to talk about the liturgical calendar as a celebration of the life of this cosmic warrior. So God seeks the church, the Catholic Church does its very best to integrate human experience with God's experience, our experiences of time, our experience of joy, our experience of sorrow, all centered on the person of Jesus. So in that context, I'm going to read you a little quote that I have just on Kairos and Chronos. So if you're still like, I really don't know what those words mean, Chronos is quantity. What Chronos is it? It's the time something happens. Kairos is quality. Kairos is sacred time. It is the moment of something significant, and it is opportunity. Chronos in Greek is used a couple times in the New Testament. In Colossians 4, verse 5, conduct yourselves wisely, making the most of the time. Kairos. And then in Mark, beware, keep alert, for you do not know when the time will come. Mark 13:33. It's a time for something. So when you look at the Catholic Church,
And you try and make sense of, like, well, why do you do, like, you do the same thing every Sunday, sort of. You go through the same cycle. There's a whole lot of intention and reason behind it. And it starts from this point that human beings must celebrate time. And so Jesus comes as the pinnacle of all history, and he sets time on itself, and now the Catholic Church revolves around the life of Jesus, because the only goal of Catholicism is to come into contact with God through the person of Jesus in the Holy Spirit, and with the Catholic Church. So we have Jesus here at the center. This is Jesus. Give him a crown maybe? That's terrible. No, okay. Skip the crown. We're just going to go with the stick figure here. Jesus with a misshapen head. Okay, Jesus. Let's talk about Jesus. When we talk about liturgy, we're talking about a work for the people. And at the center, Catholicism, one fair question that everyone should ask is, like, is Catholicism really about Jesus? I mean, when you look at all the externals, it's a fair question to ask. And I think more people should ask it. Like, prove to me that the Catholic Church is all about Jesus, because it doesn't seem like you're all about Jesus. And the answer is yes. And that's because literally the entire life of the Catholic Church is scheduled around Jesus. So we have a liturgical calendar that starts in December. You're like, what? What is wrong with you guys? You missed it by a month. No, we did it on purpose. Okay. It starts with a particular season. So our liturgical calendar is divided into seasons, not unlike natural seasons. Again, because we believe that God is the creator of all time, that God is the creator of Kairos and Kronos, and that there is some sort of inner connection here, and they become concrete in the person of Jesus. So in the church is looking at the life of Jesus and saying, is this the spiritual rhythm of God's connecting Kronos with Kairos? And the answer is yes. Okay, what's the first liturgical season? Does anybody know? All right, Advent. Advent is our first season. Now I'm going to try and draw you a circle. Later I'm going to put up a slide of, like, what this should look like, and you can make fun of what I drew. All right, we're going to start here. Advent. Actually, it usually starts over here. Advent. Okay. And what does Advent start with? Like, what's the kickoff? If you're thinking, okay, well, what are we talking about when we're talking in Advent? The impending birth of Christ, right? All right, so this is where you're hearing a lot about preparation. You're going to hear from the beginning parts of the synoptics in our readings. And we use the color purple. Okay. In Advent, we often use a phrase called, that is something like, prepare the way. That's your little tagline for Advent, prepare the way. Why do you think Catholics use the color purple in Advent? Sorry?
Royal.
It's royal, yes. It's royal. The color of the emperor, so royal. It's also, oddly enough, penitent. So while Advent is not like a season of abstinence for Catholics in the same way that Lent is, where we're fasting, we're aiming for purification, it is a period. Advent is a period in the Catholic Church where we prepare the way. Just somewhat different than this idea of staying and watching, like in Lent. Prepare the way is
where we're on a journey. We are on a journey in this season to go and find the Lord. Okay? Now, royal, purple, one of my favorite, so cosmic warrior of sin and death. Jesus is a cosmic warrior come to conquer sin and death. Mark is writing to Roman Christians, and he has this awesome phrase. So this is happening in Rome, and gospel, the word gospel in Greek, does anybody know what it is? It's evangelion. And the evangelion is a worldly term. It means news and good news. It's good news from Rome. So there were lots of evangeliums from the conquering, that like the guys from the army, they would come into Rome and they would shout out the good news of like all these great conquering things, and all the great spoils and yada yada. So Mark gives the good news at the very beginning. So right from the gate, he says, I have an evangelium. And he's writing to Roman Christians. Let me tell you about the real good news. Let me tell you about the real Savior, the real God of the world. Because Caesar proclaims himself as God, both royal. And then he lays out Jesus as the cosmic warrior who's come to conquer sin and death. And Bishop Barron says that when in antiquity, often Jesus is criticized, like, you Christians, you have such a puny God. Like, he came as a poor baby. Look at my God. He's ripping off people's faces. And Bishop Barron says, what powerful warrior does not slip behind enemy lines? Right, so Jesus knows what he's doing. He's not there for shock and awe. He is a tactical warrior. He knows how to fight the battle. So in Advent, we are preparing the way. We are watching. You hear a lot about John the Baptist. We are watching. It is called a season of expectation. Now, that obviously makes sense in kind of a really an odd way. It's not intended to be a season of expectation in the way that we often experience it, but what are people this high expecting? Presence, right? There's something, when the church says expectation, she thinks of the one great present, the greatest gift. Which is what? Jesus. So there is something, again, very natural and inductive about our experience of the season of Advent. We are preparing. Does anybody know what's happening in nature in this time? It's the last week in November, beginning of the very, this year it is the beginning of December. Last year, for the last couple of years, it's been on Thanksgiving weekend. This year it falls in the first week of December. What's going on in nature? It's winter. But something bigger is going on, specifically with the sun. The days are shorter. But as we head this direction, Are there days getting darker or lighter? Lighter. The light is increasing. So it gets darker then lighter. Okay, it gets darker then it gets lighter. And the whole purpose is the church places Advent in this period of time not only for a whole bunch of reasons, and one of them is that it takes the shape of the world around us. So when you look at the liturgical calendar and the liturgical season, each season has something in the external world that relates to it. It's not just oh, how neat, what a great coincidence that right around this time suddenly the light shines in the darkness and it's getting brighter in the world. Obviously Easter falls around the same time every year. And it's meant to be in spring, and it's not a coincidence that, you know, we're talking about new life. It's because the church put it there because The Catholic Church wants to sanctify every moment of every person's life. Every chance it gets, it's trying to put you in touch with Kairos. It's trying to take you out of Chronos and put you into Kairos and actually bring to free us from the limits of Kairos. It's that kind of that clicking, the ticking clock that often pains us so much in life. And the church is constantly trying to draw us out of that ticking clock, out of the loss of time and into eternity. That my life is not in the context of how many hours I have left. It's in the context of living forever. And how can I live forever well? One of my favorite quotes in life is from the movie Gladiator, where he's standing in, at the beginning, and he says, he's with the cavalry in the woods by the Tiber, and he says, what we do in life echoes in eternity. And that is the liturgical calendar. Okay, so then what happens? Advent, da-da-da-da, and we get to what? Christmas, yay! It's everyone's favorite short season, Christmas. All right, so here's your little fun lesson. Christmas, right? That makes sense. Where'd you go? I need to find it. I saw a breakdown, and I thought, oh, I need to share this. So when you look at Christmas, the word Christmas, obviously, in this image, do you ever wonder where we got Xmas? That's where it comes from. That's where Xmas comes from. It's actually a secularization of the word Christmas. Xmas is no one needs to get offended, but by definition, it's an offense against Christians. It's literally the removal of Christ from Christmas. But specifically, we don't know how true that is. It's true because they gone and spray painted over that, like that one really important part. But that's part of where we get this whole Christmas thing and where you get the Xmas thing. All right, so then you have a season of Christmas, and Christmas is obviously celebration. It's, we're gonna use red and white and sometimes gold, okay? And we celebrate in what's called an octave, which is 8 days. And if anybody has a good reason for 8 days, you could say it now and save me from admitting that I really can't tell you why we celebrate in octaves. But in that Christmas season, so again, the church is just like, the church is decorated. You're going to see each season runs kind of a different gambit of like decoration and style and stuff like that. So Christmas is all lit up and fun and crazy and lovely. And if you've not gone to Midnight Mass on Christmas, it's really kind of a beautiful, it's a powerful thing because the liturgy is written to be powerful. It's meant to be similar to the Easter Vigil. Okay? So there are actually things that take shape in a very similar way if you have the wherewithal to go to Midnight Mass this year and you're considering becoming Catholic this year, I would suggest that you go to Midnight Mass this year if you can. My kids haven't let me in 11 years. Not 11 years, 9 years. Don't get any ideas. 9 years. But you're going to hear a lot of stuff at the Midnight Mass for Christmas that are going to sound really similar in the Easter Vigil. So, Christmas is the second most important Mass that we celebrate all year. And of the Christmas octave, the highest Mass is that Midnight Mass. Period. Okay, let's take a break. We're going to take a 5-minute break. We're going to come back, and then we're going to zip through 2 more seasons and focus on the Easter season. Okay, fun facts. While everybody gets back and gets settled,
in Advent, you're going to see this thing called an Advent wreath, which anything that we can put a candle on, we will. Hence, Advent wreath. An Advent wreath has four candles. Purple. Okay, I'm going with pink, but I will we'll talk about rose and purple. Okay. So, each candle represents a Sunday in the four Sundays of Lent. And in it, make sure that I always mix them up. It's there we go. It's Gaudere. So, we go purple, pink, or rose, because no priest wants to wear pink. Any other explanation is lacking, okay? Although I have a priest friend and who said, someone was like, oh, Father, you look so nice in rose, because she was trying to be polite. And he was like, no, I look good in pink. This is called Gaudete Sunday, and it's meant to be a rejoicing, and this is kind of where, how do I say this, the church builds in to this period kind of proof to its the season. I don't want to say it's not penitent in the sense of in the same way that Lent, and we talk about Lent as like a season of penance. And fasting and prayer, but it is meant to be a period of longing. It's meant to be it's meant to stir in us desire and expectation. So that third Sunday, this third Sunday, this pink Gaudete Sunday, is meant to be like you're almost there. It's that mile marker that you're getting to. Like, yes, we're so close. The third Sunday of Advent, traditionally named Gaudete Sunday, expresses a joyful note of this anticipation in the season. All right, other fun things, weird things about Catholics you should know. We don't sing Christmas music until Christmas. Now, if you live in the Hoyt House, you would have been listening to Christmas music starting like 3 weeks ago. Okay? Because I don't live in a church. But when it comes to liturgy, the public work offered on behalf of the people, there's no Christmas music because it is meant to be rejoicing. So, and that Christmas music is rejoicing in the birth of Jesus. So that's why you don't hear the songs that, like, you go to church and every once in a while, like during Advent, you're like, I just really want a joyful. Come on, can we do like just a little bit of Hark the Herald Angels Sing? And the answer is no. It's actually really, this is the worst time to be a musician in the Catholic Church because you like so badly want to play Christmas music and you so can't and you only get 8 days to do it. So you got to make good on them. So all joking aside, there are lots of people out there. I totally stuck my foot in my mouth and swallowed it. Around a friend who I was like, I just don't get people who don't listen to Christmas music. I wasn't being rude. I was just saying, like, I just can't imagine not doing that. And he was like, oh, we don't. Oh, okay. Well, you have great self-control, sir. But part of that, in that sense, I really admire, not to the point where I emulate, but I admire the idea that we don't listen to it because we are like building that expectation. It's that longing, which is the purpose of abstinence, fasting and abstinence and penance in Lent, is to build up that longing to go without. So there's been a positive swing in like liturgical spirituality where people will, you know, in Lent we'll talk about like giving stuff up, but in Advent also people might fast from something, but in a like a different type of way. So, so maybe you go without Christmas music. Maybe you insert something that you create a desired expectation. Like, I want to get there. I want to get to that point.
And you tie it to creating space, preparing the way for Jesus to come in, right? So there's a whole lot of spiritual theology in the Catholic Church around the creche, that Jesus would find a place born in your heart. So in Advent, we are preparing the manger and stable for the Lord to come into our hearts. After Christmas is what? Ordinary time. So ordinary. It's kind of funny. Ordinary time. In ordinary time, what is our primary color? Green. That is right. So, God bless you. In ordinary time, we are going through the life of Jesus. I want to, let's see, where is that? Yeah, that's exactly why. So right now, we will complete the cycle in the tail end into ordinary time. Spoiler alert, ordinary time is here as well. So right now, we are in ordinary time at the end of our year, our liturgical year. In ordinary time, we are focusing on the life of Jesus, right? So that seems kind of obvious, but when you look at it from the alternative perspective, we'll keep going. After ordinary time is what? Lent. And then after Lent, Easter. And I've given you a bad spatial diagram because this ordinary time is very long. And then ordinary time. Okay, so Jesus, this is anticipation of Jesus' birth. Jesus is born. This is Jesus' life and his public ministry. This is the preparation for his death. In particular, this is where we get all the juicy stuff. This is where you see lots of like all the fantastic exchanges between Jesus and the world, whether it be the Jews, the Gentiles, whether it's between him and his apostles, all the good stuff is in here. And we're missing one season, but we'll get there. Here we have his life in ministry, preparation for his death, his resurrection. And in Easter, we celebrate his resurrection for quite a long time. We are big fans in the Easter season. And then finally into ordinary time again, and that ordinary time is the life of the church. So it's post-ascension, and we read through Acts. We're reading through a whole bunch of really awesome stuff. Okay, so Advent, you got Advent, Christmas, ordinary time, Lent. I'm going to skip one because we're missing it. Easter and ordinary time again. There is one more. Yes. So it's called the Sacred Paschal Triduum. U-U-M. The Sacred Paschal Triduum is a week. So think about it this way. We're spending, you know, 4 weeks here, 4 or 5 plus or minus here, a week and change here, a whole bunch here. 1 week, we have a season. Yes.
I have a simple question.
Yes.
When you draw Christmas, you make a little symbol.
Yeah. No, it's a P and an X. So it's the Cairo. And yes, wait for it. Let me come back to it. gosh, I really should have looked that one up again. I knew you would ask that. I thought, oh, man. A year later, I have not remembered from the last time I gave this talk. Okay. So, we'll get there. Sacred Paschal Triduum. Paschal Triduum. So we spend one whole week just on his passion and his death. And we focus in. So our entire